But Henry Neal Mallon, the head of Dresser Industries, was a guy named Henry Neal Mallon, last name M-A-L-L-O-N. Henry Neal Mallon was a graduate of Yale University. He was a Skull and Bones associate of Prescott Bush Sr. So here's the networking again. He also was very, very close to Allen Dulles. Now, Allen Dulles, of course, was the powerful Wall Street lawyer who helped to cloak many of the pro-fascist business entities that George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr. were involved with. Henry Neal Mallon was a Skull and Bones associate of Prescott Bush Sr., two of George Herbert Walker Bush's Skull and Bones classmates, the aforementioned Messrs. Weaver and Walker, followed him into the intelligence community. But it's worth looking, worth noting that even at the very beginning of George Herbert Walker Bush's career, we're looking at this networking, at this power elite that basically is going to figure all through the story. It's sort of like watching, it's kind of like this is like a fascist version of Great Expectations, except when you remember the Bush family, the Great Expectations are lived up to. Not great in terms of noble, but great in terms of powerful. And if you're born with a last name Bush, you certainly are going to be born with some great expectations. And even if you can't walk or chew gum at the same time, ultimately, the power that flows through the Bushes will be able to correct an awful lot of what might be going wrong. So again, George Herbert Walker Bush attends Yale University, becomes a member of Skull and Bones, graduates, goes to work for the oil industry, goes to work for a company headed up by one of his father's Skull and Bones associates, goes to work for a company headed up by a fellow who in turn was a close associate of Allen Dulles. Allen Dulles became one of the key officials with the Office of Strategic Services, America's World War II intelligence service. Allen Dulles then went on to work for the Office of Policy Coordination, which was an entity that existed in the post-World War II period that coordinated various U.S. governmental activities in connection with covert operations. They coordinated elements of state, Pentagon, and so forth. Allen Dulles, at around this time, the immediate post-World War II period, right about the time that George Bush was gaining momentum with Dresser Industries, Allen Dulles put together something called the Crusade for Freedom. The Crusade for Freedom was an illegal CIA domestic covert operation. It also was administered in close conjunction with both the State Department and also with the Republican Party. One of the key officials with the 1952 Republican campaign was a guy named Arthur Bliss Lane, who also was doubling at the same time, was wearing two hats, was working as an official with the Crusade for Freedom. Now, the Crusade for Freedom was could be thought of as sort of a two-pronged covert operation. It was intended to establish many of these fascist and Eastern European collaborators from World War II, not only people who had directly gone to work for the Third Reich from Central and Eastern Europe, but also members of some of the collaborationist fascist political parties from that part of the world. In addition, of course, to Nazi Germany and Italy and Japan, the Axis embraced at one time or another Finland, Slovakia, Croatia, the Baltic states of Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. It also embraced Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary. And all of these countries had their own fascist political parties as well. Because the United States has a large Eastern European ethnic community, and because many of these Eastern European, quote, ethnics, unquote, had traditionally been democratic voters. They were employed as blue-collar workers in industry. Many of them lived in the urban centers of the industrial Northeast and Midwest, and these were traditional bastions of democratic political strength. It was seen as not only politically expedient for the Republican Party, but also seen as being expedient from a national security standpoint to lead these people to the right, basically to win them over to a reactionary political viewpoint. And at the same time, in order to wage the Cold War in Europe, many of these same elements were being recruited, obviously, under the auspices of the Galen spy outfit and related organizations to work as to work as physical combatants in various aspects of covert operations in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Now, the Crusade for Freedom was, as I said, it had really two prongs, one of which was European, and the other of which was domestic. Now, this was a domestic covert operation. The CIA was specifically forbidden from engaging in covert operations in the United States by its charter. Nonetheless, the Crusade for Freedom proceeded on course. The Crusade for Freedom, which actually resulted in the bringing, the importation into the United States of Central and Eastern European fascist collaborators and Nazis, including some were actually veterans of the Waffen-SS, veterans of the Einsatzgruppen and the mobile killing units that followed the Nazi frontline units into the former Soviet Union. Many of these people were war criminals of the First Order, and their entry into the United States was completely illegal. But they were brought into the United States, and they were installed as leaders in many of the civic leaders, as political leaders, in many of the Central and Eastern European ethnic communities in the industrial Midwest and Northeast, specifically to try to win these voters, this very important voting bloc, away from the Democrats, and to, in general, to turn those groups in a reactionary political direction, because, of course, many of them identified with their country of national origin, and these countries were, at this point, under Soviet domination, so their ardent and activist anti-Soviet and anti-communist sentiments were seen as being politically necessary. But the Crusade for Freedom actually resulted in the importation of Central and Eastern European Nazi and fascist collaborators, their physical importation into the United States and their establishment as leaders in many of our Eastern European ethnic communities. This was completely illegal. And ultimately, as we're going to see, this political milieu was to evolve into a formal wing of the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Ethnic Heritage Council, or Ethnic Outreach Organization. This had been coalesced on the part of the Republican Party only during presidential election years, but during the tenure of Richard Nixon, and we're going to talk about him in just a second, it was formally incorporated as a permanent element in the Republican Party. And it was this entity that cropped up in 1988, briefly, when the press, for a couple of days anyway, shined a little bit of light onto this organization when it was campaigning for George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988. Bear in mind that George W. was, to a large extent, micromanaging his father's election campaign in 88. Now, Alan Dulles was the person, basically, the Crusade for Freedom was his godchild, so to speak. He was the architect of it. This is the same Alan Dulles who was friendly with Henry Neal Mallon, the skull and bones classmate of Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker Bush's first boss. This is the same Alan Dulles who had been heavily involved with setting up the holding companies and the cloaking operations that helped to disguise some of the corporate entities that George Herbert Walker and Prescott Sr. had been involved with that had been supporting Hitler and Mussolini. I'm repeating some of these connections because we're going to see a lot of these, we're going to see this networking evolve through generations and over decades, and it's ultimately what's going to bring us to the candidacy of George W. Bush. Now, the fellow who managed the Crusade for Freedom for Alan Dulles was a young rising congressman, rising in the Republican ranks, named Richard Nixon, whom, again, perhaps some of you heard of, and I'm not trying to be snide or cute with that, but Richard Nixon was very, very close to Alan Dulles, and Richard Nixon administered the Crusade for Freedom for Alan Dulles. And bear in mind that two of George Herbert Walker Bush's skull and bones classmates, again, the aforementioned Howard Weaver and Samuel Sloan Walker Jr., only 15 bonesmen in each class, but they became deeply involved with the Free Europe Committee and the Free Europe Press Committee, which were basically two of the State Department intelligence fronts that were involved with the Crusade for Freedom. Now, the fellow who was the chief spokesperson for the Crusade for Freedom was a young Hollywood actor at the time named Ronald Reagan, again, a name whom some of you may have heard of. The fellow who headed the, who actually performed the State Department operations to bring these people into the United States, completely illegal, was William Casey. William Casey had been a key official with the Office of Strategic Services, again, America's World War II intelligence agency. He had worked very closely with Alan Dulles, and he then headed up the International Rescue Committee, which brought many of these people in because they were supposedly victims of political persecution, which I guess is nothing if not original. The idea is that they could not be brought into the United States if they were fascist collaborators or war criminals, but if they were victims of political persecution, then they could be. It was William Casey who arranged the State Department machinations to bring these people into the United States, acting in his position as head of the International Rescue Committee. Bear in mind that later on, of course, Richard Nixon is going to be, as we're going to see, very, very close to George Herbert Walker Bush. And, of course, William Casey ultimately became the manager for the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, and then became director of Central Intelligence for the bulk of the Reagan administrations after dying, and up until he died in December of 1986. But again, the Crusade for Freedom is an institution which, or an episode, I guess would be a better way of putting it, which in many ways illustrates the networking that I'm talking about. Again, it was hatched by Alan Dulles, administered by Dulles' protege, Richard Nixon. The spokesperson for this was Ronald Reagan, and the fellow handling the State Department machinations to bring these people into the United States in the first place was William Casey. And we're going to watch this cast of characters and others who will enter from the wings and play upon this stage through a period of decades. And right now we're in the early 1950s in terms of the time frame that we're looking at. In 1952, Dwight Eisenhower named Richard Nixon to be his vice presidential candidate. Richard Nixon had basically made his career as a political entity by being a professional anti-communist, pursuing Helen Gehagen Douglas, the wife of actor Melvin Douglas, mother, by the way, of Kirk Douglas, and grandmother of, who is that? I don't know, Michael Douglas. He's the current the fellow on the scene. I don't keep up with Hollywood that much, but Helen Gehagen Douglas had been a liberal congresswoman in California, and Nixon destroyed her political career by targeting, he called her the Pink Lady. Richard Nixon's first congressional campaign was financed by Mickey Cohen, who was the syndicate boss of Los Angeles, and was administered by Murray Chotiner, who was a mob attorney who handled most of the legal work for Mickey Cohen. And Murray Chotiner, basically, was an organized crime attorney whom everyone who is familiar with Richard Nixon's political history acknowledges was basically the fellow who managed Richard Nixon's political rise, at least in his early days. Again, Nixon began political life as a congressman. The fellow who bankrolled his first congressional campaign against Helen Gehagen Douglas was Mickey Cohen, the syndicate boss of Los Angeles, and this was administered for Cohen by Murray Chotiner, an organized crime attorney who went on to become one of the key dirty tricks administrators when Richard Nixon ascended to the White House. We're going to talk about some of the networking that took place at that time that follows right on up through the years, or that courses on up through the years in a few minutes. It should be noted that there are persistent rumors, which may be true. The fact that I'm characterizing them as rumors is simply because that has never been confirmed, but it has been stated by knowledgeable people that the person most responsible for persuading Dwight Eisenhower to take on Richard Nixon as his vice presidential candidate was Prescott Bush Sr. Certainly the two families are very close politically. In his autobiography, George Herbert Walker Bush describes Richard Nixon as his political mentor. And again, Richard Nixon was administering the Crusade for Freedom on behalf of Alan Dulles, whose connections to the Bush and Skull and Bones milieu we've already touched on. It may or may not be true that Prescott Bush Sr. was the main lever or the main vehicle for getting Richard Nixon the number two spot on the Republican ticket in 1952, but certainly the two families, the Nixons and the Bushes, are very, very close. And we're going to take a look at the networking that takes place between the Bush and Nixon forces during the course of this discussion. Bear in mind that in 1952, the Crusade for Freedom was in full swing, and bear in mind that in the person of Arthur Bliss Lane, who was working for the Crusade for Freedom and was one of the main officials for the 1952 Republican campaign, we have one individual who was basically wearing two hats. So I think there's a very good chance that the stories that Prescott Bush was the main force behind getting Eisenhower to accept Richard Nixon as vice president are true. Certainly, the networking is there. Again, bearing in mind where Prescott Bush Sr. comes from, going all the way back to his Skull and Bones days, his work for his father-in-law, George Herbert Walker, for the Nazi-linked companies on Wall Street that were seized by the alien property custodian. Then he begins to pull strings on behalf of his son, gets him a job with his Bonesman classmate, Henry Neal Mallon's drilling firm, Dresser Industries, Mallon very close to Dulles, Dulles close to the Bushes in a manner I've already described. But in any event, Richard Nixon goes on to become vice president under Dwight Eisenhower, and they serve basically two terms going up to 1960. Now, in an article entitled In the Company of Friends in Covert Action Information Bulletin Number 41, Anthony Kimmery suggests and cites confirmation from unnamed anonymous intelligence officials that the entire time that George Herbert Walker Bush was employed in the oil industry, he was also working for the CIA. And so his career as an oil man, in all likelihood, was the more visible element of a career that also embraced his role as a CIA officer. Officially, at least, George Herbert Walker Bush was only with the CIA for 1 year, 1976, January of 76 to January of 77. That is difficult to believe. For one thing, it's extremely unlikely that an outsider would be named head of the CIA. Beyond that, it's worth noting that the CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia, have been renamed for George Bush. I think it's very unlikely that they would have renamed the headquarters of that building for a guy who'd only been with the institution for 1 year. They would have named it, you know, the Alan Dulles Center or whatever. But Anthony Kimmery suggests that the entire time that George Bush was working for the intelligence community, working for the oil industry, he was also working with the intelligence community as well. Ultimately, of course, John F. Kennedy defeated Richard Nixon for election in 1960. At this time, George Bush was beginning to flex his political muscles as well. He was entertaining notions of running for Congress. He finally did in the 1960s. It's worth noting that Richard Nixon was heavily involved with covert operations, not only dating back to the Crusade for Freedom, but also dating to his period when he was vice president, when he had much to do with overseeing the covert operations directorate of the CIA in his position as vice president. It's worth noting, too, that the same cast of characters crops up in a big way in the series of events surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy. George Herbert Walker Bush's name crops up. Of course, again, Nixon was not elected in 1960. JFK was elected. JFK ran afoul of a great many very powerful elements. I'm not going to go into the Kennedy assassination specifics due to limitations of time. Like the story of the Western financing of Hitler, that's a very important story and one that would be the focal point of a lecture in and of itself. But it's worth noting that it was one of the most important political events of the second half of the last century, and that this same cast of characters' names crop up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. First place, Richard Nixon, whom George Herbert Walker Bush describes as his political mentor and who may have gotten his position as vice president as a result of Prescott Bush Sr.'s activism. Richard Nixon certainly part of this network at this time, having administered the Crusade for Freedom for Alan Dulles, and in that capacity interfacing with people like Ronald Reagan and William Casey. Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, flew out about 2 hours before Kennedy was killed, yet when interviewed by the FBI on February 28th of 1964, Nixon claimed that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas was, quote, 2 days prior to the assassination, unquote. This despite the fact that the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers, carried an interview with Nixon in their November 22, 1963 issues conducted in Dallas, Texas, 2 days after Nixon claims he left Dallas, Texas. Another person who was not in Dallas, Texas, but over Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963 was George Herbert Walker Bush. He was in the plane of somebody called Mr. Zeppo, about whom I know nothing and about whom I have read nothing prior to or since, but he was being flown by in the private plane of a Mr. Zeppo, Z-E-P-P-O. Who he is or was, I do not know. I've never seen another reference to that, but in a current biography of George W., George Herbert Walker Bush was in the plane of a Mr. Zeppo and actually had to circle Love Field in Dallas a couple of times to wait for Air Force One to take off, burying President Kennedy's corpse, a Freudian slip, burying President Kennedy's corpse back to Washington, D.C. George Bush's name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination in several different contexts. A person who has been identified through the address as being George Bush contacted the FBI and said that a John Birch Society activist in Houston, who had expressed hostility to Kennedy, may have been involved in the assassination. This has been confirmed as having been George Bush. I suspect that may have been a misdirection play, as it is called in football. George Bush may have very well been leading people in another direction and perhaps leading people away from his own activities. People familiar with the operations of Zapata Oil have claimed that it was frequently used by the intelligence community as part of the anti-Castro operations in the 1960s. Zapata Oil's main focus of activity was in Mexico and the Gulf of Mexico. It has been claimed that Zapata Oil was heavily involved with the anti-Castro efforts of the CIA. Certainly the milieu involved with that, the JM Wave milieu in Miami, was deeply involved with the milieu that killed President Kennedy. A George Bush of the CIA was dispatched by the CIA to the Miami area to gauge the reaction of the anti-Castro Cuban community. He was then to report back to J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI. This came out in The Nation magazine in 1988. It was claimed that this was a different George Bush. This was some other George Bush, and they cited the individual that was supposed to be. It turns out that this person was nowhere near Miami, Florida, was doing nothing on behalf of the CIA, suggesting that George Bush of the CIA was in all likelihood George Herbert Walker Bush of the CIA, the same fellow that we're talking about this evening. It's also worth noting that a good friend of George Herbert Walker Bush's was a guy named George de Morenshield, who had been a white Russian. He had in all likelihood spied for Nazi Germany in World War II. His father had managed the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family, and then nicknamed the Russian Rockefellers, same family that ultimately invented dynamite and financed the Nobel Prize. George de Morenshield was also one of Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitters, and he worked for German intelligence for a period of time in World War II, was very close to Baron Hugo Meydel, who for a time headed up the Abwehr, German military intelligence in the United States, and he was actually arrested on suspicion of spying and taking pictures of the Aransas Pass, Texas Coast Guard station during World War II. George de Morenshield was a very close personal friend of George Herbert Walker Bush. His name and address were in George Herbert Walker Bush's address book. Bear in mind, too, that when he later became Director of Central Intelligence, George Herbert Walker Bush actively frustrated the CIA's cooperation with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. We're going to get to that a little later. That, of course, took place in the mid-1970s, after Richard Nixon exited during Watergate, after Gerald Ford became president and ultimately named George Bush as CIA director. Take note, by the way, that Gerald Ford, who was House Minority Leader, became a key member of the Warren Commission. We're going to come back to Gerald Ford. Bear in mind that Dick Cheney, the head of Halliburton Oil, which now controls Dresser Industries, George Bush's first employer. Dick Cheney is the head of Halliburton Oil. Dick Cheney was George Bush's Secretary of Defense. He was Gerald Ford's White House Chief of Staff before that. So some of this networking is going to be stretching through a period of decades. Alan Dulles, the same Alan Dulles who set up the corporate cloaking on behalf of the Bush family's corporate entities, the same Alan Dulles who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom, the same Alan Dulles who was a good friend of Henry Neal Mallon of Dresser Industries. Alan Dulles sat on the Warren Commission helping to determine, quote-unquote, the true assassin of President Kennedy. Of course, Alan Dulles had been fired by President Kennedy for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs. Should also be noted that a Warren Commission counsel figures in this particular scenario. That's a guy named Leon Jaworski, who was an attorney working for the Warren Commission. He also was one of the two co-counsels for the Texas Court of Inquiry, the Texas state body set up by then-Texas State Attorney General Wagner Carr to investigate Kennedy's assassination on behalf of the state of Texas. Leon Jaworski had been heavily involved with the Nuremberg trials and had been one of the people who had helped to see to it that only the most heinous Nazis even stood trial at Nuremberg. In particular, Jaworski was instrumental in seeing to it that very lenient justice was administered with regard to the euthanasia trials, the trials of physicians who had engaged in so-called mercy killing on behalf of the Third Reich. The co-counsel of the Texas Court of Inquiry with Leon Jaworski was also a very interesting fellow named Robert Story. Robert Story, in an earlier incarnation as Colonel Robert Story, had also been involved with the prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg and had passed the word down the line that the anti-Nazi statutes were to be, quote, relaxed, unquote. Because again, Leon Jaworski then served as a Warren Commission counsel and was in charge with seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had connections to the intelligence community. And Leon Jaworski concluded that in fact he had none. After this period, after President Kennedy was assassinated and after LBJ became President of the United States, ultimately George Bush was elected as a congressional representative from Texas and was serving in that capacity when Richard Nixon was elected president in 1968. Now, one of the things that Richard Nixon did when he became President of the United States was to formally incorporate this Nazi emigre milieu that I've been speaking about as a permanent element of the Republican Party. The head of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization was a Hungarian fascist named Laszlo Pásztor. That's spelled P-A-S-Z-T-O-R. Pásztor had been part of the Arrow Cross organization in Hungary, the Hungarian fascist party that was allied with Hitler. When Richard Nixon became president of the United States, bear in mind that Nixon oversaw the Crusade for Freedom for Dulles and worked in that capacity with Ronald Reagan and William Casey. When Richard Nixon became president of the United States, he incorporated the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization into the Republican Party as a permanent entity. And the person who was chairman of the Republican National Committee when this was done was George Herbert Walker Bush, who was named as head of the Republican National Committee during Richard Nixon's second term. So bear in mind again, George Herbert Walker Bush's claim that Richard Nixon was his political entity, and bear in mind also the claim that Prescott Bush Sr. was the person who got Richard Nixon his place on the 1952 Republican ticket. Should be noted that in the same time period, a clandestine operation appears to have been undertaken in which the National Cancer Institute was involved with researching viruses, which appears to have ultimately resulted in the development of AIDS and the perhaps deliberate spreading of AIDS in, among other places, third world countries. Interestingly enough, and this in and of itself is a very long story, and this is something that I've gone into in some of my discussions with Len Horowitz, perhaps the focal point for a lecture in and of itself, but it's worth noting that at this very time period, it was deemed to be essential to American national security to hold down populations in third world countries, in other words, to control population spread in third world countries, Africa in particular. It was also around this time that U.S. began backing vaccination programs, subsidization of vaccination programs in third world countries. Now, that's interesting because if you want to hold down population, because expanding population in third world countries was seen as potentially threatening the interests of the United States, because if populations expanded past the point, it would strain the infrastructure, strain the resources, and that this would lead to revolutionary sentiment and left-wing radicalism in third world countries, and perhaps result in their, quote, going communist, unquote. That at least was the theory. Interestingly enough, the congressman that was holding the hearings into the dangers of third world population explosion for American national security interests was Congressman George Herbert Walker Bush. He chaired those hearings, and one of the people that he called in to give expert testimony in these hearings was none other than William H. Draper, Jr. Now, William H. Draper, Jr. had been the fellow who had been a specialist in investing in pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany for Dillon Reed and Company. He then was appointed head of the economic reconstruction of Germany, or the top official with the economic reconstruction of Germany in the post-World War II period, and saw to it, basically, that the business lines were kept on track as they had been prior to World War II. The economic denazification of Germany quite simply never happened. And it was that very same William H. Draper, Jr., who was called upon by George Bush to give expert testimony about the need for holding down population in the third world because it would endanger American national security interests. Why this particular individual was deemed an expert on third world population and the political implications of same is a matter of some conjecture. I would note that his son, William H. Draper III, became a key financial backer of George W. when George W. Bush followed his father into the oil industry. William H. Draper's son, William H. Draper III, became a key financial backer of George W. Again, the networking word, the N word, figuring prominently here. Ultimately, of course, Richard Nixon was forced from office. We should note that among the cabinet officials that he named was none other than William Casey, who became head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. That's the same William Casey who was heading up the State Department machinations to bring the Nazi and Eastern European emigres into the United States under the Crusade for Freedom. Ultimately, of course, Richard Nixon became ensnared in the Watergate scandal, which forced him from office. Nixon ultimately was obliged to resign when he refused to turn over tape segments to the special prosecutor. That special prosecutor was a very special prosecutor indeed. It was none other than Leon Jaworski, the Warren Commission counsel and a member of the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit, who was named by Richard Nixon to be Watergate special prosecutor after Nixon fired Archibald Cox, who, by the way, had been John F. Kennedy's solicitor general. The controversy with regard to the Watergate cover-up, according to H.R. Bob Haldeman, was that Nixon was worried that if the tapes were released and that if Watergate was not covered up, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, would come out. Haldeman wrote in his book, The Ends of Power, that the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a code word in the Nixon White House for the Kennedy assassination. And indeed, when you study Watergate, one finds a great many evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the assassination of President Kennedy from Watergate. But it's worth noting that before Richard Nixon ultimately left office in Watergate, he had, as I mentioned, named George Bush to be head of the Republican National Committee, which George Bush was when Richard Nixon resigned. Ultimately, Bush wrote Nixon a letter advising him to resign and advising him that, among other things, if he did not, that some of the Nazi political skeletons in the Republican closet might become public if, in fact, there was a full-blown investigation into Watergate. The day after George Bush wrote to Nixon advising him to resign, Richard Nixon resigned. Now, when Spiro Agnew was forced out as vice president because of some of his scandals, the person that Richard Nixon named to replace him as vice president was Gerald Ford, the same Gerald Ford who had been a member of the Warren Commission, along with Alan Dulles, again, a key member of this network whose evolution we're tracing this evening. Gerald Ford, of course, became president when Richard Nixon resigned. He then pardoned Richard Nixon of any crimes that he might have committed, not just during his during his days as president, but any crimes committed, period, which might very well cover his activities in Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963. Ultimately, Gerald Ford named an up-and-coming politician named Dick Cheney to be his White House chief of staff. Cheney eventually served in Congress as a congressman from Wyoming. Gerald Ford also needed a new director of Central Intelligence, and in January of 1976, Gerald Ford named George Herbert Walker Bush to be director of the CIA. So note again the networking between Nixon's and the Bushes. Richard Nixon incorporated the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization as a permanent element of the Republican Party. This was accomplished when Richard Nixon was head, or when George Bush was head of the Republican National Committee. He had been named as head of the RNC by Richard Nixon. Nixon then named Gerald Ford to replace Spiro Agnew as vice president, Gerald Ford being a Warren commissioner. Then Gerald Ford accedes to the presidency after Richard Nixon resigns and then pardons Richard Nixon of all crimes committed. Then he names George Bush to be director of the CIA, and George Bush as director of the CIA actively frustrates cooperation between the Central Intelligence Agency and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which at this point had been convened to, among other things, begin investigating the assassinations of Martin Luther King and President Kennedy. Now, Bush was officially only CIA director for 1 year. It was a very, very eventful year. And while he was director of the CIA, in addition to, as I said, actively frustrating cooperation between the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a number of interesting things took place in this time period. In the first place, a guy named James R. Bath claims that George Bush specifically recruited him into the Central Intelligence Agency and assigned him the job of liaising with the key Saudi Arabian petroleum and business interests. Now, James R. Bath later became involved with the BCCI, which was an intelligence-connected bank, deeply involved with the Iran-Contra machinations, strong connections to British intelligence, and strong connections to narcotics money laundering, and also to the bankrolling of terrorist activities as well. Oliver North had some of the accounts that he used to conduct the Iran-Contra machinations with BCCI. And James Bath was involved with BCCI and claims that he got involved with CIA and his Saudi Arabian business clients, and also with the airplane brokering business, something he had no experience in, at the specific direction of George Bush when he was director of Central Intelligence. It's worth bearing in mind because later on James R. Bath emerges as one of the financial backers of Arbusto Energy, which was George W.'s first oil company. In fact, something like 5% of the capital put forward for Arbusto ostensibly came from James R. Bath, but people who knew Bath at the time claimed that he had no money of his own and that any monies he would have invested in Arbusto Energy must have come from his wealthy Saudi Arabian clients. Well, one of his wealthy Saudi Arabian clients was the father of Osama bin Laden, whose name is now, of course, being bruited about in connection with the latest Middle Eastern terrorist attack. James R. Bath was the Texas representative for the bin Laden family, heavily involved with the Saudi construction interests. Bin Laden later was very active in the anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan as well. But note that James R. Bath claims that his involvement with the oil industry, his involvement with BCCI, and also his involvement with the airplane brokerage business all took place as a result of the direction of George Bush when he was director of CIA. James R. Bath had no experience in the airline business, in the airplane business whatsoever. The aviation business, he ultimately became one of the largest aircraft brokers in the United States. One wonders whether perhaps he had anything to do with getting an aircraft called 08 Foxtrot, one of Barry Seal's top drug and gun smuggling planes, into the Texas Air Armada of the Texas governor, where it now serves as the favorite airplane of George W. That is obviously a matter of speculation. While George Bush was director of Central Intelligence, the anti-Castro Cuban community was very active internationally in conjunction with not only other Latin American totalitarian elements, but beyond that was something that freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger termed the Internacional Fascista, literally a fascist international crafted by, among others, SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, a key favorite of Hitler and a key element of the Galen spy organization of the post-World War II Nazi underground, Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese, an Italian fascist and another intimate of U.S. intelligence, Italian fascists, Spanish fascists, Latin American fascists, and their American counterparts collaborated in an international terror campaign whose perhaps most heinous element was something called Operation Condor. This was an international assassination consortium that was put together by various Latin American dictatorships, Bolivia, Paraguay, Argentina, Uruguay, and a few other countries, Brazil. And they actively, they used the active assistance of Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese fascists and collaborated actively with elements, note my use of the term elements, of U.S. intelligence. When the anti-Castro Cuban organization CORU, spelled C-O-R-U, all in capitals, launched a series of bombing attacks both on more moderate members of the anti-Castro Cuban exile as well as on Cuban targets and on others perceived to be spreading, quote, international communism, unquote, George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. CORU became a key element of what Kruger terms the Internacional Fascista, and the most famous of the Condor killings was the assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. in September of 1976 when George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. And when he was head of the CIA, the anti-Castro organizations, CORU, the Internacional Fascista, were at their zenith, and they flourished when George Bush was director of the CIA. Another thing that Bush did when he was director of the CIA, perhaps as his last act, was to put his imprimatur on a report, a CIA report, which forecast that there was going to be a huge downturn in not only Soviet oil production, but worldwide oil production, and that the Soviets were going to be in need of oil to keep their military and industry going. In fact, the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, was the world's largest oil producer and second largest oil exporter after Saudi Arabia. This was quite simply a fabrication, but it was also forecast that Saudi production was going to decline. This was going to result in a worldwide oil shortage, which would in turn result in a possible Soviet military incursion into the Middle East. In anticipation of same, we were told that we had to build up our own military capabilities, increase weapons shipments to the Saudis, and of course we had to do everything possible to stimulate domestic oil production and the production of oil in general. We now know that this oil estimate, this estimate of falling Soviet oil production and a worldwide oil shortage, was quite simply a fabrication. It bore no semblance of reality to what was going on either in the former Soviet Union or in the Middle East, but rather people who had backgrounds in the Central Intelligence Agency and were working with the CIA, something that's very common, had crafted this report and apparently deliberately misled the executive authority of this country. Bear in mind that the petroleum industry and the intelligence community are very closely linked, and that rather than operating at cross purposes, many petroleum industries have their own private intelligence services, and that these operate parallel to and in conjunction with the CIA. But one of the things that Bush did, and it may have been his last act as director of Central Intelligence, was to give this report to Jimmy Carter. And this in turn had much to do with shaping the perceptions of the energy situation in the late 1970s. George Bush wanted to continue as director of Central Intelligence. Jimmy Carter, however, fired him, brought in Stansfield Turner, a Navy admiral, and Turner conducted a house cleaning of some of the CIA's old covert operations directorate. Bush associates like Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, and others, people who were long-standing mainsprings, so to speak, of the CIA, to mix a metaphor, were drummed out of the agency, officially at least, and they left with Bush. Later on, the evidence suggests that many of these people did not actually leave the agency, and that in fact they continued their networking not only with other people within the CIA, but also with George Bush, and later with the National Security Council and the Reagan White House. Many of these same people crop up in a big way in connection with the Iran-Contra affair a number of years later. Now bear in mind that one of the other things that was taking place at this same time, two of the other things taking place at this same time, were the Wilson-Turpel operations in conjunction with Muammar Gaddafi, supposedly a couple of renegade CIA agents, former CIA agents, were involved with helping to arm and train Muammar Gaddafi's terrorist cadre. They were also allegedly involved with a number of other terrorist organizations as well. These people were Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel. These people have more connections than a switchboard, and they themselves would be the focal point of a lecture. The assignment of Turpel and Wilson to Gaddafi and the others took place when George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. And two of the partners in their operations were Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, two of the top officials in the CIA's covert operations directorate. Also, at about this same time, there was a Central American covert operation that was undertaken called Operation Watchtower, in which a series of electronic beacons was placed throughout the jungles in Central America in order to guide planes bearing cocaine into Panama for transshipment into the United States. This, in turn, to be used for financing covert operations. This, in turn, was conducted in conjunction with Edwin Wilson, among others. All of this is taking place during George Bush's 1 year with the CIA. Carew is going nuts. The International Fascista is going nuts. Turpel and Wilson are being assigned to work with Gaddafi, among others. Watchtower is undertaken. The phony oil shortage report, the phony oil estimates by the CIA are generated, and they had much to do with setting the stage for what came afterward. And bear in mind, of course, that George Bush actively frustrated cooperation between the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the Central Intelligence Agency. Ultimately, of course, George Bush was fired as director of Central Intelligence by Jimmy Carter and replaced with Stansfield Turner. Stansfield Turner conducted a house cleaning and attempted to reform the U.S. intelligence community's covert operations establishment, unsuccessfully, as it turned out. But what's worth noting is that the projections by the Central Intelligence Agency of a worldwide oil shortage, due to Soviet production shortfall and due to projected declining Saudi shortage, led Jimmy Carter not to give the oil companies carte blanche to explore for new sources of oil. And Jimmy Carter was not in favor of simply delimiting oil prices in order to stimulate production, but rather Jimmy Carter came down firmly on the side of petroleum conservation. This did not sit well with the petroleum industry, and there is some very compelling evidence in a remarkable and very inappropriately named book entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, that in fact the misestimates of Soviet and Saudi oil production were quite deliberate and were intended to mislead not only the White House, but also the American people in a direction that was deemed to be necessary for the interests of the petroleum industry.